So it's 7:00 p.m. Your client's major acquisition is supposed to close tomorrow morning, and opposing counsel just sent over this brutal 11th-hour list of
Oh,
demands.
the classic Friday night nightmare.
Right, exactly. They want entirely new escrow conditions, heavily expanded indemnification carve-outs, which, basically shifts all the risk back to you, and a totally revised set of closing deliverables.
Yeah.
And the implicit threat is just sitting right there in the email, like, accept these changes or we walk away from the deal entirely.
Which is terrifying for any lawyer.
A year ago, if you were the lawyer getting that email, you'd be ordering bad takeout. You'd be waking up a team of three junior associates and just bracing for a miserable all-nighter of manual cross-referencing
Just hunting through hundreds of pages.
just to figure out how exposed your client actually is.
Yeah.
But last Tuesday, one lawyer did it all himself in 2 hours
Yeah.
using generative AI.
That's wild.
It really is. So welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are taking a massive stack of sources. We're talking viral practice reports, rigorous academic trials, internal law school strategy memos, and we're acting as your curated companion. We want to help you navigate what is, I mean, undeniably the fastest technological shockwave to ever hit the legal profession.
Yeah. And we really need to set the table here with a concept called model velocity before we get into the actual mechanics of that 7:00 p.m. email.
Right, because things are moving so fast.
Exactly. When we talk about AI in the legal field right now, we are dealing with an incredibly fast-moving target. The profession usually moves at a glacial pace. I mean, precedent by definition means looking backward to figure out how to move forward.
Right.
But right now we are seeing this massive, maybe 12 to 18-month gap between the vanguard, the early adopters who are just aggressively integrating these tools, and the median, which is your standard massive big law practice.
Okay, let's unpack this because to understand the theory, we first have to look at the reality on the ground.
Absolutely.
We're seeing a complete decoupling of firm size and firm capability. And that brings us right back to that midnight M&A negotiation. You have to look at what happened to Zach Shapiro.
Yeah, his story is basically the anchor for everything happening right now.
It really is. He runs this two-person boutique law firm called Reins, and they specialize in startups and venture capital. He posted a thread detailing exactly how he handled that aggressive 7:00 p.m. demand letter. And I mean, it went massively viral. It hit like 7.7 million views.
Which is unheard of for legal process threads.
Right. But instead of waking up a team, he uploaded the core documents, the purchase agreement, the disclosure schedules, the hostile demand letter directly into Claude, which is the AI model built by Anthropic.
And, the speed is what catches people's attention initially, but the analytical depth is what actually matters here.
Yeah.
Within minutes, the AI didn't just map the proposed changes, it stress tested them against the entire architecture of the deal.
Which is the hardest part of the job.
Exactly. And it spotted these critical errors that the buyer's own high-priced lawyers apparently missed in their rush to send the email out. Claude pointed out that two of the proposed carve-outs directly contradicted representations the buyer had already confirmed earlier in the disclosure
It
schedules.
essentially caught them tripping over their own shoelaces.
It did. And it found an even bigger structural flaw. The AI identified a third proposed change that would have created this internal conflict with the fundamental representation section.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so if the buyer had successfully forced that change through, they would have inadvertently weakened their own post-closing protections.
That's incredible. The AI was performing multi-layered legal synthesis across hundreds of pages of like highly technical corporate text.
Right.
So as the emails keep flying back and forth through the evening, Shapiro just keeps feeding them into Claude. And the AI is tracking how every single tiny concession interacts with provisions buried deep in the agreement.
It's acting as a partner.
Exactly. It helps him build a response, grounding every single counterposition in specific cross-references to the buyer's own previously agreed-upon language. And by 11:00 p.m., he had a perfectly clean, bulletproof set of counterpositions.
A mid-sized firm would have needed until morning to do that. They'd be burning thousands of dollars in billable hours.
And he had the core analysis done in under 2 hours, and the deal closed the next morning.
Which, I mean, this completely upends the traditional leverage model of law firms. Shapiro's realization is that a small firm built natively around AI doesn't just keep pace with a 100-lawyer firm. It actually operates with higher precision and at a cost structure that was literally impossible just 18 months ago.
Yeah.
But to really grasp how this is happening, we have to look at his specific toolset, because he isn't using a bespoke legal AI product.
Wait, really? Because I found this part fascinating, and I want to push back on it a bit. I see ads for specialized legal AI everywhere now. Why wouldn't a lawyer use a tool that's specifically trained for lawyers?
Well, Shapiro is pretty blunt about this. He calls these specialized vertical legal AI products wrappers.
Wrappers, like they just wrap around the real thing.
Basically, yeah. Using a legal AI wrapper is essentially like hiring a translator to speak to someone when you both already speak the exact same language perfectly. It just adds a middleman.
Oh, yeah, I see.
These specialized tools take a frontier model like OpenAI's GPT-4 or Anthropic's Claude, and they just wrap it in a custom user interface. Maybe they add some firm-specific templates or guard against certain prompts.
Which, you know, sounds helpful in theory. It feels safe.
It feels safe, sure. But it inherently filters your intent. Mm-hmm. It slows the whole conversation down. Shapiro argues that these wrappers actually get in the way because they obscure the raw capability of the frontier model.
Right, like putting training wheels on a motorcycle.
That's a perfect analogy. When you use a wrapper, you are at the mercy of that vendor's engineering team. You have to wait for them to decide what feature to build next or how to implement a new model update. But when you use the raw frontier model directly, every single new cognitive capability ships to you on day one.
It fundamentally changes how you view the friction of legal work. Because think about what actually drives junior associates crazy at 2:00 a.m.
Oh, it's never the high-level strategy.
Never. It's the formatting styles that refuse to cooperate in Microsoft Word.
Yeah.
It's the track changes that corrupt the document when you send it back and forth.
Yes.
It's the cross-references that suddenly go stale because you deleted paragraph 4B and now 50 other paragraphs are numbered wrong. Or like Blue Book citation formatting where you were literally hunting for italicized periods.
The worst.
Shapiro makes a brilliant point here. He says these are not legal problems. They are software problems.
And general-purpose AI solves software problems by writing software. This is a massive paradigm shift. General models are trained heavily on coding languages. So when Shapiro tells Claude to apply tracked changes to a contract, he isn't using some clunky Word plugin that crashes half the time.
Right. The AI actually reaches into the code of the document itself. I had to read this section of the source material twice because it genuinely sounds like science fiction.
It really does.
It opens the document at the XML level. And XML is basically the invisible skeleton, the underlying markup language, that tells Microsoft Word how a document should look.
Exactly.
And Claude writes the exact markup code that Word expects, attributed to Shapiro's name, preserving every single formatting detail, and just spits out a perfectly clean red line.
It entirely removes the physical friction of practicing law. I mean, it is the difference between having an associate who can verbally tell you what is wrong with a contract and an associate who can actually fix the document, format the text perfectly, produce the red line comparison, and draft the cover email to opposing counsel.
All without you having to click through five different applications.
Right.
But I have to play skeptic here, especially regarding the technology's limitations. If you have ever used a standard AI chatbot, you know about the context window problem.
Oh, the amnesia.
Yes. If you have a long enough conversation, the AI starts to get amnesia. It forgets what you told it an hour ago. It loses the thread of the logic. So if Shapiro is doing a massive multi-million-dollar M&A deal, how does he preventing the AI from forgetting a crucial clause buried in, like, paragraph 12.
That is the exact technical hurdle that separates casual users from the vanguard. Shapiro isn't just typing into a web browser. He uses Claude's desktop application, specifically utilizing a feature called co-work mode.
Co-work mode.
Okay. Yeah. Most people just use standard chat mode where you type a question, it types an answer. Co-work is fundamentally different because it is semi-autonomous.
What do you mean by semi-autonomous?
You point the AI at a specific local folder on your computer's hard drive. You give it a set of instructions, and it goes to work. It can read multiple files, cross-reference them, create new ones, and edit existing documents directly on your machine.
So it's essentially acting as a local agent, not just a chatbot in a browser window.
Precisely. And to solve the amnesia issue, that context window limitation, Shapiro, forces the AI to create its own external durable memory.
How does it do that?
He has Claude manipulate local Markdown files. Markdown is essentially a stripped-down, plain text format without any complex graphical formatting, which makes it incredibly lightweight and easy for the AI's brain to read and remember.
Oh, okay.
So as the deal progresses, the AI writes summaries, open issues, and confirmed representations into these Markdown files. It is basically taking meticulous, perfectly organized notes for itself, which it can instantly recall at any point in the negotiation.
He also uses something called skills, right? which are these human-readable files that encode his specific, highly honed legal judgment on how to tackle a task. It's like he created a zip file of his own brain.
That's a great way to put it.
He details exactly how he likes to approach a specific type of indemnity clause. And he can deploy that customized logic at scale whenever the AI encounters that issue.
Which means the AI isn't just giving him generic law school answers. It is applying Zach Shapiro's specific legal philosophy to the text.
That is so powerful.
And we are seeing this exact same operational shift inside major tech companies themselves. Look at Anthropic's own internal legal team. Mark Pike, their associate general counsel, has fundamentally restructured how a corporate legal department functions.
He's the one with the vintage payphone on his desk, right?
Yes, that's him.
I loved that detail. Where you tap a challenge coin against it, it rings, and an AI bot figures out what you need and routes you to the right attorney. It sounds like a fun Silicon Valley gimmick, but the underlying metrics of what they've achieved are staggering.
Well, the gimmick is just the interface. The reality is that they have cut marketing review turnarounds, which is a notoriously slow process where lawyers have to check every single piece of public-facing copy. They cut it from days down to hours. Wow.
They have completely automated standard contract redlining. They have standardized complex privacy impact assessments. Pike's stated goal was to transition the legal team from being perceived as the department of the bottleneck where projects go to die, to being cross-functional thought partners who actually accelerate the business.
I'm still skeptical about the research side of this, though. Drafting and editing text is one thing. But one of our sources, Chandler, highlights a recent development where Claude can now integrate directly with Westlaw and Lexis.
Right, the research databases.
Yeah, and legal databases are notoriously clunky. They're highly proprietary and locked behind massive paywalls. So how is an AI model pulling complex circuit splits where different federal appeals courts disagree on a point of law without just hallucinating fake cases? I mean, we've all seen the headlines about lawyers getting sanctioned for citing AI-generated case law that doesn't actually exist. It's a completely valid skepticism, and it goes back to understanding how the tool is actually functioning. In those early, highly publicized failures, lawyers were treating standard chatbots like search engines.
Right, just asking for a case.
Exactly. They asked ChatGPT for a case, and the AI, which is fundamentally a predictive text engine designed to sound plausible, just invented a case that sounded perfectly real. But with browser extensions and the co-work mode, Claude isn't just trying to recall case law from its static historical training data.
It's acting as a navigator.
Yes. It is actively logging into Westlaw with the user's credentials. It is typing queries into the search bar, reading the actual verified black letter law summaries that Westlaw provides, clicking through to identify circuit splits, reading the key law review articles, and then synthesizing that live grounded data into an annotated bibliography.
Oh, so it's reading the live database.
Yes. It is using the exact same verified database a human associate would use. This effectively collapses the distinction between an AI tool and a legal research tool. They are no longer separate categories. The AI is the operating system for the research.
So if you are sitting at a mid-sized firm right now, What is the realist takeaway from all this practice velocity? Matt Schumer, one of the foremost observers of this transition, gives some incredibly blunt advice. First, he says, have no ego about it.
Such good advice.
Yeah. If the managing partners of elite boutiques are spending hours a day figuring out how to prompt AI, you cannot afford to dismiss it as a passing fad. You cannot assume your specific, highly nuanced subfield of law is uniquely immune to automation, because it isn't.
And Schumer's second piece of advice is more of a financial warning. He tells lawyers to get their financial house in order.
Which is chilling, honestly.
It is. We are entering a period of profound structural disruption. The traditional billable hour model, where firms make their margins by throwing an army of junior associates at a massive document review project, is going to face intense downward pressure from clients who know this technology exists. Having personal financial resilience gives you options if the ground shifts under your firm faster than the partners expect.
But whenever we talk about feeding client documents into an AI, the elephant in the room immediately becomes privilege and security.
Of course.
I see this debate constantly. Whenever Shapiro posts about his workflow online, lawyers jump into the comments pointing to the Heppner case out of the Southern District of New York.
Oh, yes, the Heppner case.
In that case, Judge Rakoff ruled that a criminal defendant who used a consumer version of Claude to research his legal strategy had absolutely no reasonable expectation of confidentiality. and therefore waived his attorney-client privilege.
It is the most critical distinction a practitioner needs to understand right now. In Heppner, you had a pro se defendant, someone representing himself, using a free consumer-facing web tool on his own initiative.
Right.
And if you read the terms of service for consumer AI products, they explicitly state that the company can use your inputs to train future versions of the model. So by typing your legal strategy into that box, you are essentially broadcasting it to the machine's global training data set.
You're handing your secrets to the vendor.
Exactly. But Shapiro and the entire vanguard of practice are not using consumer tools. They are operating on enterprise AI tiers with strict zero data retention policies.
So the data isn't saved.
Right. These are enterprise-grade contracts where training on user data is legally and technically disabled. The AI is simply processing the data ephemerally, generating work product at the direct supervised instruction of counsel, and then discarding the memory of the interaction.
And didn't the judge mention that?
He did. Judge Rakoff actually noted in his Heppner opinion that the legal analysis regarding privilege might differ significantly if a licensed attorney had securely directed the AI use. So while the courts are still mapping the exact boundaries, the vanguard is moving forward confidently with enterprise-grade security architecture.
Okay, so that is the reality on the ground in the Wild West of legal practice. We know it works for a brilliant solo practitioner at midnight. But does that speed and quality hold up in a rigorously controlled environment? Like, what happens when you take these tools out of the hands of an early adopter and test them on 100 law students in an academic lab?
Because if the practice reports are the anecdote, the academic scholarship is the hard data.
Exactly.
And as we move into analyzing this empirical scholarship, we have to issue a massive blinking red caveat for the listener. This is the model velocity caveat.
Which is so important to remember.
It is. The randomized controlled trials and peer-reviewed studies we are about to discuss were conducted using AI models available in late 2024 and early 2025. Because AI capabilities are currently improving on an exponential curve, the findings in these papers represent the absolute lower bounds of frontier capabilities. Whatever these studies show the AI is successfully doing, the models available right now, today, are already significantly more capable.
Which makes the data from this first study simultaneously thrilling and honestly kind of terrifying. Daniel Schwartz and a team of researchers ran an incredibly rigorous randomized controlled trial, an RCT testing real complex legal tasks on 137 upper-level law students from the University of Minnesota and the University of Michigan.
They set up a brilliant experimental design. They split the students into three distinct groups. The first group used a tool called Vincent AI. This is a specialized RAG tool.
RAG, meaning Retrieval Augmented Generation. Let's define that quickly for the listener.
Go for it.
Imagine a brilliant librarian who can't memorize every single book in the building, but has a perfect instantaneous index card system. When you ask a question, the librarian first retrieves the exact right books, opens them to the right pages, and only then formulates an answer based purely on the text in front of them. That's RAG. It grounds the AI's generation in a retrieved, verified database to prevent it from making things up.
That's a perfect analogy. So group one has the RAG tool. Group two used OpenAI's O1 preview, which is fundamentally different. It's a reasoning model. And group three was the control group. So standard, highly capable law students doing standard legal work with traditional research tools and zero AI assistance.
And the results for the AI-assisted groups were staggering. Across five of the six complex legal tasks they tested, the students using AI saw productivity gains of 50 to 130%.
130%? That's huge.
They were finishing high-level legal work in less than half the time. But the speed isn't even the most important headline here. Older studies on early models like GPT-4 show that while people got faster, the quality of their work sometimes degraded because they got lazy and just accepted the AI's first draft.
Right, the automation bias.
Exactly. But this new study showed a massive, measurable boost in quality.
And that quality boost is heavily tied to the architecture of reasoning models like O1 Preview. Older predictive models just guess the next most likely word in a sequence. Reasoning models are trained to pause, generate a hidden chain of thought, evaluate multiple potential strategies, discard the weak ones, and structure complex logical arguments before they ever start outputting text for the user to read.
The researchers used a metaphor that completely clarified this for me. They said using these advanced AI tools isn't just like going bowling with the bumpers up in the gutter so you can't possibly throw a gutter ball. The AI is actually acting as a world-class coach standing behind you.
That's a great image.
Right. It's analyzing the lane, telling you exactly which way to ball to use, adjusting your grip, and pointing to the specific arrow on the wood you need to aim for. It actively elevates your baseline capability.
But a rigorous deep dive demands that we look at the friction points. Where did the AI fail to provide a massive advantage? The study found that for highly structured, predictable, template-driven tasks, like drafting a standard mutual non-disclosure agreement, the AI provided almost zero relative benefit.
Wait, why? If it's so smart, why did it fail at an NDA?
Because drafting a standard NDA is essentially a retrieval and data entry task. A competent human law student in the control group simply pulls a reliable NDA template from a database and fills in the client's name, the governing law state, and the term length. The human can do that almost as fast as the AI.
Oh, that makes sense.
Generative AI doesn't shine in rote replication. It shines in synthesis and pattern recognition amidst chaos. When the researchers gave the students complex, messy tasks like analyzing a convoluted multi-count complaint or drafting a highly strategic, persuasive settlement letter, the AI reasoning models allowed the students to achieve exponential leaps in both the quality and depth of their legal analysis.
Because it's doing the heavy lifting.
Exactly. The AI offloaded the tedious cognitive burden of basic issue spotting, freeing the human student to focus entirely on higher-level strategic reasoning.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We cannot look at this through rose-colored glasses. We have a powerful counterweight to that optimism in the scholarship. We have a study by Lisa Larimore-Ouellette and her colleagues, and it dives straight into the danger zone of AI reliance.
This study is fascinating.
These four law professors took their own 2023 patent law casebook, a textbook they literally wrote, and fed it directly into three different frontier AI models to see if the AI could effectively hold office hours for their students.
They designed 185 specific, highly technical patent law questions that a typical student might ask while studying for an exam. They tested OpenAI's GPT-4o, Anthropic's Claude 3.5, and Google's Notebook LM.
And the data here is incredibly sobering. They found that GPT-4o produced responses that were actively harmful to student learning 26% of the time. Google's Notebook LM was harmful 31% of the time. Claude 3.5 was the best of the bunch, but it was still harmful 14% of the time.
And we have to unpack what harmful means in this context because it is insidious.
Yeah, it's not what you think.
These were not obvious glaring hallucinations. The AI wasn't inventing a fake Supreme Court case about patenting a time machine. If the AI hallucinates something that bizarre, the student immediately knows it's wrong. The danger lies in the plausibility.
Right. The AI would give a beautifully formatted answer. It would use perfect legal formatting, like an impeccable IRX structure issue, rule, application, conclusion. It would sound highly confident, but it would be legally incorrect or dangerously misleading.
The underlying mechanism of the failure is fascinating. Because language models are designed to identify probabilistic patterns across vast amounts of text, they naturally gravitate toward general rules. In law, however, the entire game is played in the margins. It's played in the highly specific, hyper-technical exceptions to the general rule.
Oh, I see.
The AI might accurately state the broad doctrine of patent obviousness, but completely miss the razor-sharp exception detailed on page 412 of the casebook that the student was specifically asking about.
It averages out the text and smooths over the sharp edges. And if a law student doesn't already know the answer, they fall right into the cognitive trap. They see the good formatting, they see the confident tone, and they have absolutely no way of knowing the AI is leading them down a blind alley. They study the wrong rule, and they bomb the exam.
Exactly. The researcher's conclusion is a stark warning. Any attempt to rely entirely on an AI model for primary learning is fraught with pedagogical peril. The user must possess sufficient baseline knowledge of the subject matter to catch the subtle hallucinations. The takeaway is that AI is currently a powerful study aid like a sounding board for ideas, but it is absolutely not a substitute for rigorous primary reading.
Which immediately raises the inverse question. If AI struggles to act as the flawless teacher holding office hours, can it act as the evaluator? Can a machine grade a complex law school exam?
This is where things get controversial.
Really controversial. This brings us to a frankly astonishing study by Kevin Cope and his co-authors. Six law professors across top 30 U.S. law schools took real, anonymized student exams from four core doctrinal subjects and compared their own human faculty grading against AI grading.
The metric they discovered is going to make a lot of traditional academics uncomfortable. When the AI was provided with a detailed, structured grading rubric by the professor, the AI's assigned grades correlated with the human professor's grades at a Pearson coefficient of up to 0.93.
Wait, let's explain that coefficient clearly for a second. A Pearson correlation of 1.0 means perfect, absolute lockstep alignment. A 0.93 means that if the human professor read a torts essay and decided it was an A-, the AI almost certainly gave it an A- as well. They are in near-perfect agreement.
And to put that 0.93 into proper perspective, you have to look at the baseline fallibility of human grading. Human-to-human reliability is rarely anywhere near 1.0. If you take the exact same stack of 50 contracts exams and give them to two different brilliant professors, they will absolutely not give every student the exact same score.
Because humans are human. We get tired. We get hungry right before lunch, and maybe we are a little harsher on the exam we read at 11:45 a.m.
Exactly.
Or we suffer from the halo effect, where a student writes an absolutely brilliant, flawless first essay, and the professor's brain unconsciously biases them to give that same student a higher score on a mediocre second essay, just because of the lingering glow of the first one.
The AI does not get hungry. It does not suffer from cognitive fatigue at 2.8 a.m. It applies the provided rubric with mechanical, unyielding consistency to the first exam and the 50th exam. Now, I should say, the paper is careful not to argue that AI should entirely replace human faculty graders. We aren't turning the credentialing of lawyers over to a black box.
Right, that would be a tough sell.
Instead, they position the AI as a powerful validation tool.
Like an anomaly detector.
Exactly. A professor could grade the exams themselves, have the AI independently grade the same stack, and then the professor only needs to deeply investigate the handful of exams where their human score and the AI score diverge significantly. It acts as a safety net against human bias or fatigue.
That makes a lot of sense.
Furthermore, it opens the door to something law students have begged for decades, which is substantive feedback on practice exams. Faculty simply do not have the hundreds of hours required to grade ungraded midterms. An AI model can ingest a student's practice essay, compare it to the professor's rubric, and instantly provide detailed, constructive feedback on where the student missed key issues.
But, I mean, you can't bring up students in AI without running headfirst into the grade cheating panic. Every law school faculty lounge in the country is having the exact same argument. Like, how do we stop them from using ChatGPT to write their final exams?
John Landa's work completely reframes this entire debate.
Let's talk about that.
Landa's perspective is profound because it turns the problem inside out. He argues that if a university assessment is measuring a skill that a generative AI can effortlessly automate, then the AI is not the problem. The assessment is the problem. It is measuring the wrong thing. We are currently watching universities engage in this unwinnable dystopian arms race of AI detection software.
And we know those detectors don't work. They throw false positives constantly, and they disproportionately flag students for whom English is a second language because their prose tends to be more structurally rigid, which the detector confuses for machine generation.
Precisely. Lenar argues that AI cheating isn't a policing issue. It is a signal that we need to fix the pedagogy upstream. If a take-home memo can be written by Claude in 4 seconds, we must move away from these high-stakes end-of-semester summative exams.
So what's the alternative?
We need to transition toward continuous formative assessments where students are required to demonstrate their live reasoning process, maybe orally or in secure environments, adapting to changing facts in real time.
It is the ultimate forcing function for higher education. And it isn't just the students who are being forced to adapt. Fraser and Rosenstein wrote a fascinating piece called Large Language Scholarship, looking at how generative AI is reshaping legal academia itself, the very nature of how law review articles are written.
Right, the faculty themselves.
We are looking at a dual-edged sword. On one side, you have unprecedented scholarly productivity. You have democratized access to empirical analysis, where a professor who doesn't know how to code in Python can use an AI to analyze thousands of court dockets to find a hidden bias in sentencing.
But on the other side, you have the terrifying risk of scholarly deepfakes. Papers that look methodologically rigorous, complete with beautifully formatted footnotes, but are built on entirely machine-generated, hallucinated nonsense.
Which would be disastrous.
There is also the deeper risk of cognitive de-skilling among the faculty themselves. If an academic outsources too much of their deep structural thinking to the machine, they lose the capacity to genuinely synthesize complex legal theory.
Okay, so let's zoom out for a second. We have solo practitioners operating like big law firms. We have academic data proving massive productivity leaps mixed with dangerous hallucination risks. We have grading potential, and we have a fundamental disruption to how legal scholarship is produced.
It's a lot.
If you are leading a massive elite institution right now, how do you actually adapt? because universities are generally not known for their lightning-fast agility.
Which brings us to the institutional response, specifically looking at the strategy being developed at Pencarry Law. We have insight into a multi-tiered proposal championed by Deputy Dean Polk Wagner under discussion with Dean Sophia Lee, who approaches this with a philosophy of measured urgency.
I love that phrase, measured urgency. It acknowledges the fire without, you know, running blindly for the exits.
Wagner breaks the proposed strategy down into three distinct tiers. Tier one is the foundational philosophy, the adaptive architecture thesis. This is a proposed AI initiative built on four core pillars: research, people, building, and pedagogy. But the theoretical framework is what matters most. Wagner explicitly argues against making a massive, permanent, programmatic bet on a specific technology right now.
Because of model velocity.
Exactly. If a university spent 3 years raising funds and designing a static center for prompt engineering based on how ChatGPT 3.5 worked 2 years ago, that center would be laughably obsolete before the ribbon-cutting ceremony. The technology completely reinvented itself while the building was being planned.
But I want to push back on the term adaptive architecture. It sounds a bit like administrative buzzword bingo. What does an adaptive architecture actually look like compared to a traditional university center?
A traditional center is rigid. It hires tenured faculty for specific, narrow subfields, creates a rigid curriculum, and measures success by the number of traditional papers published over a 5-year grant cycle. An adaptive architecture, by contrast, is essentially about building institutional muscle memory.
Muscle memory, okay.
It is the capacity to constantly observe the frontier, pilot new tools rapidly in small test cases, pivot gracefully when a model update changes the rules of the game, and adapt the curriculum continuously. It is creating a flexible container for innovation rather than a static monument to today's technology.
That makes total sense. You aren't building a boat to navigate a specific river. You're building a shipyard that can produce whatever vessel the water requires.
Exactly.
And that leads to tier two, curriculum integration. They aren't just writing white papers about AI. They are putting the friction directly into the classrooms. They are actively integrating AI into the mandatory legal practice skills courses for 1Ls, the first-year law students. They are also launching highly specialized AI law lab boot camps in specific practice areas like corporate and litigation.
They are forcing the students to engage with the tools in a structured, supervised environment before they ever touch a real client's file. And tier three is the tech layer. This is where the institution actually built proprietary infrastructure.
Right, Heron.
Yes. They are developing an internal platform called Heron. This is a custom teaching assistant built on Claude Code, designed specifically to interact with law students securely. Alongside that, they are developing open source skills and prompt libraries for the faculty to use, ensuring that the professors aren't falling behind the technical capabilities of their own students.
But all three of these tiers, the architecture, the boot camps, the tech infrastructure, they are all in service of one overarching educational goal. They are trying to produce what they call the 10x lawyer. And I know 10x sounds incredibly tech bro, like something you'd hear in a Silicon Valley pitch deck, but the underlying concept is vital.
It really is.
AI is not going to replace lawyers, but it is going to aggressively, disproportionately reward a fundamentally different kind of lawyer.
The 10x lawyer is not just someone who types a clever sentence into a chatbot. The 10x lawyer is a professional whose core judgment is amplified exponentially by AI. We are talking about someone who has mastered supervisory judgment. They understand complex workflow design.
System thinking.
Yes. They employ systems thinking to take a massive, unstructured legal problem, like a hostile corporate takeover, break it down into modular executable tasks, deploy AI agents to handle the initial analysis of those tasks, and then meticulously synthesize the output.
They are the conductor of the orchestra, rather than a solo violinist trying to play every single instrument at once.
Yeah, beautifully said. But, and this is the most critical constraint of the 10x lawyer, they must learn these advanced supervisory skills on top of traditional legal doctrine, not instead of it. You cannot effectively supervise an AI drafting a complex merger agreement if you do not fundamentally understand the underlying contract law yourself. You won't know if the AI's hallucination is brilliant strategy or professional malpractice.
Okay, but hold on. I have a massive glaring problem with this. You are a 1L right now sitting in a torts class. How on earth do you learn supervisory judgment if you haven't even learned how to write a basic legal brief yet? How do you know if the AI's analysis of proximate cause is legally sound if you have never had to suffer through writing that analysis yourself from scratch?
And that profound contradiction brings us to the heart of the crisis. It brings us to the unanswered questions, because you have just articulated the central pedagogical paradox threatening legal education today.
This is the running theme across all of our sources, the work question. For over a century, the fundamental historical assumption of the American law school has been that the work itself is the pedagogy.
Yes.
Students sit in the library, they read hundreds of dense, impenetrable appellate cases, they outline the rules, they write agonizingly long briefs, and they draft endless memos. Writing is incredibly slow, it is frustrating, it induces tears, but that very struggle, that painful wrestling with the text, is exactly how the cognitive muscles of legal reasoning are built.
The friction was the point. And generative AI completely fundamentally subverts that historical trade-off. It drops the marginal cost of producing legal text to effectively zero. It does the work for you, or at least it produces a draft that looks remarkably close to the finished work.
Right.
Therefore, a student with a looming deadline can easily choose to outsource the wrestling to the machine. The traditional pedagogy was intentionally designed to induce cognitive strain, and the AI product is intentionally designed to eliminate it.
So if the law student's role in the real world is inevitably shifting from being a producer of raw text to a supervisor of AI-generated text, how do we adapt our testing? Because right now, the entire law school assessment model is built entirely on producing text under extreme time pressure. Let's look at the actual numbers from Polk Wagner's presentation at the Penn Carey Law Faculty Retreat.
The stats are striking.
Across the fall 2024 and spring 2025 semesters, there were 115 total exams administered, and they were split almost perfectly down the middle. 50.4% were traditional, timed, in-class exams, and 49.6% were take-home exams.
That 50-50 equilibrium is deeply structurally destabilized right now. Wagner identifies three specific compounding forces causing this destabilization. Force number one is accommodations. The traditional exam system is heavily reliant on intense time pressure as the primary sorting mechanism. But as universities rightly grant varying time accommodations to different students, we are forced to ask a difficult question. What underlying skill are we actually measuring?
Is time pressure the fairest way to test reasoning?
Exactly. Is it the fairest, most accurate mechanism to reveal distinctions in legal reasoning?
And force number two, obviously, is the AI itself. Frontier models can easily pass straightforward legal essays. They can crush policy questions. They can ace multiple choice questions. They might still struggle with highly layered, nuanced professional judgment, but a standard AI can comfortably churn out a solid B+ exam in seconds. How do you regulate a take-home exam in that environment?
You can't. And that brings us to force number three, the market for grades. Law firm hiring timelines have aggressively accelerated. Major big law firms are locking in their summer associate classes earlier and earlier, sometimes recruiting students just months into their first year. Clerkship hiring is moving earlier as well.
So what does that mean structural?
It means that students have very few actual grades on their official transcript when they sit down for these career-defining interviews.
Which means every single grade carries immense disproportionate weight. The stakes for absolute fairness and comparability in grading have literally never been higher.
Right.
Precisely at the exact moment when AI makes verifying the authenticity of student work nearly impossible.
So we have arrived at the bleeding edge. We have explored the vanguard of practice with Zach Shapiro. We looked at the empirical RCP scholarship proving both the massive gains and the hallucination risks, and the adaptive architecture strategies being drafted by elite institutions. But we do not have all the answers. The sources present six massive, unresolved questions, areas of genuine, intense uncertainty that the entire legal ecosystem is actively wrestling with right now.
Let's volley these six questions back and forth. Let's unpack them, because these are the existential questions you need to be pondering, whether you are a hiring partner looking at resumes, a law professor designing a syllabus, or a 1L trying to figure out how to survive. Question number one. What are we actually testing on exams if AI can do the writing?
Right.
If the mechanics of prose grammar, structure, basic citation are fully automated, what is left? Are we just testing raw issue spotting? Are we testing pure memorization and recall in a closed network room? Or do we need to completely flip the script and test how well a student can critique and correct an intentionally flawed AI-generated legal memo?
Question number two strikes at the heart of the institution. Does a Claude native 1L curriculum still retain the traditional 1L courses as we know them? If the ultimate goal of a law school is to produce a 10x lawyer who understands complex systems design and automated workflow, does it still make sense to teach contracts, torts, and property in completely isolated historical silos? Or do we need to build a fundamentally different pedagogical architecture from the first day of orientation, blending technology and doctrine simultaneously?
That's a huge one. Question number three, how do you determine rank in class if AI collapses the variance between the best and worst writers? We have seen empirical studies in other fields, management consulting, software coding, that show AI acts as an incredible leveler. It helps the bottom-performing workers the most, lifting their output up to the median while providing only marginal gains to the top performers.
It smooths everything out.
Yeah. If AI smooths out the writing quality across the entire 1L class so everyone sounds like a competent professional, how do top law firms distinguish the truly brilliant, innovative legal minds from the students who are just highly competent AI prompt operators?
Question number four is purely ruthlessly practical. Who pays for these enterprise tools? If an elite law school expects its students to learn how to practice on secure, zero-retention enterprise AI models so they aren't inadvertently feeding sensitive clinic data into the public domain, those enterprise licenses are incredibly expensive.
Does the university foot that massive recurring bill?
Exactly. Do they pass the costs on to the students in the form of higher tuition? Or does this create a horrifying new digital divide where elite, well-endowed schools train the 10x lawyers and under-resourced schools are left teaching 20th century skills?
Question number five challenges the entire brand of higher education. What is a law school's pedagogical identity when base model AI parity is reached everywhere? Think about it. If every single law student in the country, from the Ivy League to a regional night school, has a $20 a month AI on their phone that possesses the entire corpus of American jurisprudence and can instantly synthesize case law, what makes a degree from an elite institution distinct? Is the value simply the human network? Is it access to specialized faculty mentors? What is the university actually selling?
And finally, question number six, which brings all of this full circle to the work question. How do you teach professional judgment when the generation of options is automated and the selection among those options is the actual lawyering?
The selection is the lawyering.
Yes. If the machine can instantly generate 10 perfectly articulated, plausible arguments for a motion to dismiss, the lawyer's job is no longer to draft the arguments. The lawyer's job is to select the one single argument that has the highest probability of persuading this specific judge in this specific jurisdiction on this specific Tuesday. But how on earth do you teach a student that intuitive selection mechanism if they haven't spent years painfully generating those bad arguments themselves and learning why they fail?
Wow. These are the questions that will define the next decade of the profession. We've covered an immense amount of ground in this deep dive. We started with Ak Shapiro's midnight M&A negotiation, utilizing Claude to rewrite the friction of corporate practice. We moved through the rigorous empirical RCTs, proving that reasoning models can double productivity and raise quality while simultaneously acknowledging the 26% hallucination rates that make AI a dangerous substitute for primary learning.
And we explored the adaptive architecture and institutional boot camps being built at Penn Carey Law.
And we laid out the deep pedagogical paradoxes threatening the traditional model of legal education.
The overarching, inescapable conclusion from all of these sources is that this transition is unavoidable. The vanguard is pulling away from the median at an unprecedented, accelerating rate. The goal for any professional is no longer to resist or ignore the integration of these tools, but to integrate them with fierce, rigorous, and critical intention.
So what does this all mean? That is exactly where we want to bring you into the conversation. We want to point you directly to the chat, the comments, or wherever you are discussing this deep dive. Pick just one of those six massive open questions we just debated and defend it vigorously from both sides. Tell us where Schwartz, who measured those massive 130% productivity gains, and Ouellette, who documented the dangerous 26% harmful hallucination rates, actually disagree on the fundamental reliability of these models in a learning environment. Or, if you work in higher ed, tell us what you think practically distinguishes a truly adaptive architecture from just another traditional, slow-moving university center with a new coat of paint. We want to see you wrestling with this material.
And to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over, let's return to the harsh economics of the legal business. If Zach Shapiro's two-person boutique firm can routinely execute the complex corporate work of a mid-sized big law team, doing it in a fraction of the time, and producing cleaner, highly accurate work product, what happens to the traditional billable hour leverage model?
The pyramid falls apart.
It does. Big firms are fundamentally built on a pyramid structure. Highly compensated partners sit at the top, supported by a massive, expensive base of junior associates billing thousands of hours a year for manual document review, cross-referencing, and basic drafting. What happens when corporate clients fully realize that they are paying a massive premium for the human wrestling that a machine can accomplish in seconds? The AI itself isn't practicing law, but the person practicing law natively with AI is about to rewrite the fundamental economics of the entire profession.
It all comes back to the vanguard and the median. You can keep your head down, you can keep manually cross-referencing your contracts, and you can pretend the ground isn't moving beneath your feet. But the gap between the edge and the center is widening every single month. Thank you so much for joining us in this deep dive. Keep exploring the sources, keep wrestling with the unanswered questions, and we will see you next time.